New York Symphony Space has presented NPR's Hit Public Radio series Selected Shorts since 1985. Selected Shorts is coming to Kane Stage at Enloe Recital Hall for a night of festive storytelling filled with love, laughter, and nostalgia. I had a wonderful opportunity this week to meet the host of that event, two-time Tony Award winner for his role in the smash hit Fun Home, and his portrayal of John Wilkes Booth in Assassins. Playbill has called him arguably the most versatile leading man on Broadway, and those who have seen him as the demon barber of Fleet Street in Broadway's revival of Sweeney Todd, as Juan Perón in Evita, and the pinball wizard in The Who's Tommy, as well as singing and playing guitar in his own band, Loose Cattle, certainly know that's the case. Let's head to New York City and chat with the amazing Michael Cerveris.
Speak to me, friend. Whisper.
I'll listen. I know you've been locked out of sight all these years. Like me, my friend. Well, I've come home to find you waiting. Home, and we're together, and we'll do wonders, won't we?
We are thrilled to have Michael Cerveris here in New York City with us. What an honor it is to meet you.
I'm thrilled to be here.
So tell me how you got involved with Selected Shorts.
It's been years now. I can't remember what my first story was, but it was at Symphony Space, the home for Selected Shorts. And for years I was a devoted listener, and I would hear Selected Shorts from New York and from Los Angeles when they would do it out there. And Isaiah Sheffer was the host then, and I always thought, man, this sounds so fun and so cool. And one day I really would love to be part of it, but I didn't know anybody who was part of it. Occasionally, I would hear actors that I was friends with, but I never sort of found out how the mysterious combination of things happened that led to you getting to do it. And then one day, I don't remember how or why, but I just showed up on somebody's radar, and they said, "Hey, would you ever, do you like to read things aloud?" And I had been doing some books on tape and things like that, and I really enjoyed it a lot. And they said, "Well, there's this thing called Selected Shorts." And I said, "Oh, I know all about it. And if this is an invitation, then yes." So, and I've done it on and off for a number of years, and it's been exciting to do it up at Symphony Space, and then also really exciting to get to do it out on the road. I've gone to Dallas and a bunch of places in New Jersey and the sort of metropolitan area, and it's particularly exciting to sort of take it on the road.
Are you allowed to tell us what you'll be doing on the 16th?
I'm hosting and then introducing the three stories that we'll be doing that night. One is an adaptation of the Gift of the Magi that Dana Ivey and I will be reading. They're all really great stories, and they're particularly good at choosing stories for me. I think that this is true of everybody. I think they probably start with a story first and then find just the right person to deliver that for the audience. So they've always found stories for me that were challenging and often kind of character-based, often with some sort of surprise twist in them. But every time it's been when they've sort of given me the story and said, "Now here's a story, do you think this would be one that you would like to read?" Every time it's been like, "Yeah, this is, I can't believe I didn't know this story before." So,
well, you have not only a magnificent singing voice, but your speaking voice is so inviting. So a night with you telling stories with, you know, fellow actors, it's a special evening for anybody who's going to be coming to Kane Stage. What do you think about when you do this kind of work, where you're reading a story as compared to playing a character? What's the difference?
That's an interesting question. I think when I'm reading a story, it's not dissimilar from when I'm in a recording studio with my band and recording music. I think there's a, when you're focusing on just the auditory expression and not really imagining a lot of visual components to it, I feel like you're sort of talking really directly into the ear of the listener. And even when it's taken out of a recording studio and put on a stage, I still feel more that, you know, it's kind of like we're in a big bedtime story, and as far as I'm concerned, everybody could close their eyes and we could turn the lights down and I would, you know, just read like that. In fact, maybe I'll suggest that sometime. But it's a very personal kind of storytelling, and it really, I think the thing I like so much about it is that it distills everything down to the essence of the story. There's no visual tricks, there's no gimmickry. You really have only your voice and the text to kind of take your listeners someplace. And I like the challenge of that and the simplicity of that and the intimacy of it. And I guess what's even more fascinating is having that kind of direct intimacy in such a communal setting. I mean, there just are not enough chances for us as people to get together and to gather. It takes us back to some of the oldest cultural events, sitting around a fire and, you know, somebody telling a story about something. And, you know, Selected Shorts kind of does that. And it's a rare and exciting and really kind of life-affirming event.
Storytelling is what public radio has always been about. When I talk to my students, you know, I tell them constantly, you know, that's what people remember of the stories that you tell, not the facts and figures, but they'll go and tell somebody else, hey, did you hear this? So of the stories that you have told as part of the Selected Shorts, which one sticks in your mind more than anything, maybe surprised you or changed you in some way?
Wow. I'm always so bad with these kinds of, like, what was the best, what was the worst, what was a terrible accident that happened to you in the middle of some performance? I think because every one of them has moments of that. I think, you know, and the most recent one is the one that you kind of remember the most. But I do remember there was a Nathan Ellender short story that I read a few years ago that was one of these stories that kind of takes you on that takes you to a place that you had no idea you were heading towards from the beginning of the story. It was one of the stories that really kind of took me to a different place. And I read it several times, and each time I felt like I, you know, got something new out of it or arrived at a different place, you know, by the end of it. And that's, you know, those are my favorite kind of stories. But everyone. Every one of them has some aspect of that, I think. And I like to try to approach them without a great deal of, unlike, as we were talking about earlier, the amount of research and preparation I like to do for roles. When I'm reading stories, I'll read it through once or twice just to make sure I know how to pronounce everything and that I, you know, I'm not surprised to find out that I've been, you know, giving the wrong voice to one character the whole time. But I try not to do an excessive amount of preparation because I like to be reading the story and discovering it as close to the same way that the audience is hearing it. And I like to kind of be in the same sort of moment of discovery that the audience is. So, whether it's just an excuse for laziness or an actual valid work ethic, I like to sort of be prepared but not over prepared and just be experiencing it and exploring it live at the same time that I'm sharing it with the audience.
And not every actor can do this, can make these stories come to life. It's a real skill. How about storytelling for you? Did mom or dad, we know mom was a dancer, dad was a professor of music, they met at Juilliard. Of course the son that they have is going to be this great Broadway star and TV star. I mean, it was meant to be kind of, but did they tell you stories at night?
Well, they, you know, they sent myself and my brother and sister all to, you know, good schools where I think they hoped we would learn, you know, a really useful trade, but we all ended up in the arts instead after all. And it's not surprising when you grow up with music and art and dance and theater so much a part of your upbringing. They did read me stories, although I remember, in fact, they read me stories so much. They read me, I think it was a Dr. Seuss book, and I memorized it from them reading it to me so many times. And before I could actually read myself, I would apparently sit down when there was company over, and I would tell them I was going to read them the book, and I would read, you know, Green Eggs and Ham or whatever it was, and I would turn the pages because I had memorized what was on every page, and I would recite what I was supposedly reading, although I wasn't actually reading it, and turn the pages. And so that was probably my earliest acting performance, was pretending to be able to read when I couldn't read and reciting books that had been read to me. So I loved, you know, I loved being read to. I read to my little brother, I think, at some points. I don't know if I read to my sister, because she was not much younger than I was. But I've always enjoyed reading to people. And sometimes, you know, I've read to friends. Or there was a while when there were some radio drama companies. There's so many in England. I think there still are. There certainly were a lot before, and I wish there was more of that here, because I love doing that kind of thing. But stories have always been a huge part of my upbringing, and the, you know, the whole move to podcasts and things now is, I wasn't really a radio generation kid. My dad was, and I guess he probably instilled in us a lot that joy of auditory story experience. And listening to the radio, we would listen to tapes of old radio shows, cassette tapes, 8-track tapes probably, in long car trips when we were kids. We didn't always have pop music radio on, because my dad was a classical musician and couldn't abide a lot of pop radio. But we could listen to Bob and Ray and, you know, The Shadow and all of that. And some of the best parts of family trips were late at night with just the, you know, the station wagon's headlights being the only light around, and listening to old-time radio shows. And so I think, yeah, storytelling and listening to stories has been a big part of my whole life.
Boy, if Michael Service would start a whole radio drama series, I would listen. Well, I would listen, and a lot of people would.
And I would hire you, too, because you have a fantastic voice also.
I appreciate that. Michael Service is hosting a special night on the Kane stage at NLO Recital. It's Saturday, November 16th at 7:30. The Tony Award-winning Broadway star is hosting actors Dana Ivey and Richard Masser. What do you want to tell us about Dana and Richard and working with them and knowing their work?
Well, I haven't gotten the chance to work with Richard at all. Dana and I have been in like concert performances and benefits and things, but we haven't actually gotten to read together. So this is going to be an exciting, you know, first for me too. I just am an admirer of both of their work over the years. And like you were saying, it's very true. Not every actor is well suited to this kind of thing. There's a certain combination of egolessness but also very very strong ability to inhabit a character just through your voice that's essential in doing this kind of work. And I've seen people who are fantastic actors who are just not all that good at reading stories, because they try to do something with it, or they can't kind of let go of needing the audience to respond to them. And, you know, like they say, you know, sometimes they say it's the singer, not the song. In this case, it's the story, not the storyteller. It's really the people I think who are most successful at doing this kind of thing are actors who are able to just inhabit the world of the story in a very self-effacing kind of way. And Dana and Richard are both those kinds of actors. You know, they inhabit the roles that they play. They work from the story first and from the text first. And yet they're also very beloved and appreciated actors for their body of work, and people will see them and immediately remember all of the things they've seen and love them in. So you have that immediate kind of familiarity and connection with them, which makes them reading you a story all the more appealing. So I can't wait to go just so that I get to listen to them read too.
Damn my soul, if you must let my body turn to dust, let it mingle with the ashes of the country. Let them curse me to hell, leave it to history to tell what I did well, and I did it for my country. Let them cry, dirty traitor, they will understand it later. The country is not what it was.
Want to go to, you talk about how you really research. You've played some of the most interesting characters, real characters in real history. John Wilkes Booth, winning a Tony Award for The Assassins. You played General Juan Perón in Evita. When you go through that whole run, does that person change in your mind where they are in history, what you knew about them, because you've kind of molded them into the Michael Cerveris view of them?
Well, absolutely. I mean, partly because generally I don't know everything that there is to know about these people when I first start working on something. So simply by learning more of their life and putting them into a context that's not simply your first thought when you hear the word Juan Perón or when you hear John Wilkes Booth. And then also, I think because of the process that is required to consider them as a human being separate from the singular act or group of actions that we think of when we think of them. You know, they were somebody who was a little kid at one point and who had parents and who had relationships and who had disappointments and achievements and things like everybody does. And so being able to see any person, but especially a historical person that we feel we know well, in context in their whole life, inevitably changes your view of them and humanizes them. And I resist when people say that, you know, the actor's job is always to sort of argue the worldview of their character, and it's the director and the writer's job to sort of put that worldview in context and, you know, to condemn what there is to be condemned and to celebrate what there is to be celebrated. Your job as an actor generally is just to fight your character's point of view. And if everything is balanced, then that point of view, if it is skewed or twisted or you know, malevolent, gets counteracted by the rest of the production, so that you're not sort of just by playing Adolf Hitler, you're not endorsing Adolf Hitler. Just by playing John Wilkes Booth, you're not endorsing everything that he did. But I think it's really a valuable, I found it very valuable just to me as a artist, but also as a human being, to take time trying to walk in the shoes of people that I think I have nothing in common with, or that, you know, whose worldview is so much different and antithetical to what I believe, and to actually be able to see the world from their aside for a minute and say, okay, I still don't agree with what they did. I still don't agree with the actions they took. I still think they were wrong in these assumptions that they had. However, I understand now some of what might have led them to think that way. I think if we were taught that, and if we tried to exercise that more generally as a society, we would start finding solutions to a lot of things instead of just making anything unfamiliar or anything other somehow unknowable. It's that just makes us safe and not have to consider anybody else's point of view. And if instead we are actually thinking, oh, okay, I still think they're wrong, but I understand how they got there. I mean, at this moment in our country's history, there couldn't be a better exercise for everybody on every side of every line to be doing. And we seem to be resisting that more and more, and the results are not good.
As you listen to Michael Servers talk, you're going, wow, yeah, he knows what he's talking about. He's deep. Yale University grad, majored in theater, studied voice.
I'm scared. I had a life I thought I understood. I took it and I squeezed out every bit of life I could. But the edges of the world that held me up have gone away. And I'm falling into nothingness, or flying into something so sublime. And I'm a man. I don't know who am I now, or do I go? I can't go back. I can't find my way through. I might still break a heart or two. But when the sunlight hits the parlor wall at certain times of day, I see how fine this house could be. I see it so damn clear. Oh my God, why am I standing here?
I want to talk a little bit. I've heard you mention in interviews about how Fun Home, people really connected with your character and therefore made a huge difference. As you mentioned, well, yeah, we do it for entertaining, but when you can make a difference in people's lives, with that show, it won 5 Tony Awards. You won Tony Award. Huge show. What do you want to say about Fun Home?
I could talk to you for the next 5 hours about Fun Home. For me, I've had so many wonderful, treasured experiences in so many different shows and so many different characters that I've gotten to play. And I hope that I will have, many more. I don't know if anything will ever compare to the experience of Fun Home. I think because I can't think of many other shows that aspire to, much less achieve, that combination of meaningfulness on so many levels. I mean, just as a piece of theater and entertainment, it's incredibly successful and ingenious and nuanced, but also really entertaining, very funny, extraordinarily moving. It was also really successful, which is another rare thing, especially for something of substance in the commercial theater. It was also a chance for me to work with some of the most extraordinarily creative people I've ever met. Jeanine Tesori and Lisa Krohn were so, and Alison Bechdel's original material, they were so courageous and so selfless in the way they approached creating it. And Sam Gold was such a wise and courageous guide for everybody, but for the three of them especially as they were creating it. They would throw out songs and scenes that any other show would die to have, and they would throw them out because they were they were fine scenes. They were good scenes. They were good songs. They just weren't the right scene or the right song for that moment. So we worked diligently and doggedly through the whole process until we finally, you know, arrived at what it really needed to be in its essence, and with, you know, with no excess, and for something that wasn't a recreation of a favorite movie or a revival of something, it was something that nobody was quite sure how to turn a graphic novel into a musical, and it wasn't clear from the beginning how the story needed to be told and what it needed to be. So there was, it was just truly creative exploration from the very beginning. And then the cast that I got to work with and my, you know, my colleagues in that show are just the most dear people to me, because of the times that we got to share doing this. And, you know, and having the little kids and watching them grow up through the process, and then watching the adults, all of us, grow up through the process too. And then for all of that to arrive at a moment in our society and in our country in particular, in our city, that where we could actually tell this story and have it not just be appreciated and applauded, but have it really resonate and really affect people's lives. I mean, I've said before, you, as an artist, as a, you know, as a theater maker, you tell yourself all the time that what you're doing is important and that you're, you know, changing the world, and you kind of suspect most of the time that you're just trying to make yourself feel better about, you know, a kind of lightweight way to spend your time. It's not like you're curing cancer or building bridges, but then something like this comes up and you realize you actually are curing some things and you are actually building some enduring things, and audiences come, and we would spend, honestly, sometimes an hour, like the length of the show was doubled sometimes by the time we would spend afterwards talking to people outside who just needed to share their experiences and needed to connect or needed to tell you how it had affected them. And I was so proud of our company that people stood there and talked to people for as long as, you know, till everybody left, because we understood that we were performing a service that was more than just putting on a good show. That's the reason I ever wanted to be involved in the arts at all. You know, I received from my parents the idea that art isn't just an adornment to your life or a convenient you know, pastime, that it's really core to the experience of being human beings. And so to get to be a part of Fun Home and live that out and spend my time doing that, I will cherish it till the day I die. And I don't think, I mean, if something else comes along that does something like that, I already feel insanely lucky, and I'll just, I don't know, explode if that should happen again. But, and it's not to say that other things are not valid and you know, useful and perform something really wonderful in the world. And it's just that for me, this was kind of the ideal experience. And so it's something I carry with great pride to have been a little part of it.
Let's go back to earlier times when you played Tommy. That was another huge success. What would have happened if it wasn't, Michael? What if that would have flopped? And how would your life have changed? Would you pick your bootstraps up and say, I'm going to go and do another one? I'm going to make sure. Because it seems to me everything you touch kind of turns to gold.
Or I just do the ones that turn to lead, like, you know, way off in the dark someplace.
He ain't got no distractions. Can't hear those buses and bells. Can't see those lights are flashing. Pleased by sense of smell. Always gets a replay and never toots at all. That deaf, dumb, and blind kid sure plays a mean pinball.
It's funny you ask me that now, because I just a few weeks ago went out to La Jolla, California, and we did a reunion concert in La Jolla where Tommy began, with a large number of the original company involved and some of the original musicians, and Pete Townsend was there and was in the theater where we did it. And it's funny because I haven't really spent a lot of time thinking back to that point. The Broadway experience, which wasn't guaranteed to us at all, it began as a regional theater job. And when it finished, there was talk that it might go to Broadway, but we weren't certain whether it would, and we really weren't certain whether any of us would get to go with it or not. In the end, almost all of us did, and it was the Broadway debut for every single person in that cast, which includes people like Alice Ripley and Sherry Renee Scott and Norm Lewis and like a lot of people who've gone on to great success. But when I realized when I was out there that that had kind of obscured its real roots. And, you know, when I thought back of Tommy, I mostly thought of the Broadway experience. And because it was a lot of the same people, I sort of thought, yeah, I've been thinking about the beginnings of Tommy, but I hadn't been. And going out there to La Jolla, I had some time to just kind of contemplate that moment in my life. Up till that point, I had been doing a lot of regional theater, and when I got the job for Tommy, I was doing regional theater out west. I'd gone out to California to work on a TV show on Fame, the TV series, for the last season of that, which I thought was setting me onto this great new course. And we shot for, I don't know, 8 or 9 months, and then that was it, and the show was canceled, and I was back to doing regional theater back in Seattle and San Diego, and then Tommy happened, and in fact, when it closed in La Jolla, I then did Don John in Much Ado right after it at the Playhouse, so I immediately went back to regional theater, and I think had Tommy not gone to Broadway, or had I not gone with it, I would have just continued to do that. And I had worked with Tom Hulse a little before that up in Seattle, and I'd been so impressed. This was after he had done Amadeus and stuff, and he seemed like just such a humble journeyman actor who I thought was this huge movie star because he played Mozart with Milos Forman. And here he was just like doing regional theater. And because what mattered to him was working, and what mattered to him was being better today than you were yesterday and being better tomorrow than you are today. And I learned by example and by watching those kinds of actors through most of my early career, and modeled myself on that idea of what an actor was. I never really aspired to be on the Tony Awards. I would watch them as a kid, but it seemed to be a different kind of theater than what I thought I was doing or what I was cut out for. So I never had that goal of one day I've got to be on the Tonys. Some of my friends have from the time they were little, and they've you know, made their choices and worked diligently towards that and found their way there, and that worked great for them. Others had that goal and it didn't go that way, and they were very frustrated because of that. And it seemed to me that if you have that as a goal, you're always measuring yourself, the distance between where you are now and where that goal is. And for me, it seemed to make more sense to measure things by goals that I had some control over. You know, can I work harder and be better tomorrow? And can I learn something today that'll make me better tomorrow? I'm not going to worry so much where it takes me if where I am and where I seem to be going in the, you know, immediate future is satisfying and fulfilling. And if that's the case, then I'll let the rest of it kind of take care of itself. So I think, to answer in a long roundabout way your question, had that not happened, I would have just continued chipping away at stuff. You know, maybe I would have started to consider working in academic theater, or, you know, or all of the other things that people, places they find themselves where they can have the life they want and do the work they want to do and feel good about how they spend their time. Maybe I would have gone into a different career altogether at some point. You know, there were other things that I was interested in, and I always have had a kind of ambivalent connection to. I've never been the most ambitious actor in the world. I've succeeded in spite of myself, I think, a lot of times. And
that's called talent.
Yeah, and you know, good fortune too. But I think I would have. I wouldn't have spent time bemoaning the fact that I didn't become a star on Broadway. Not for very long. I'm sure I would have, you know, bemoaned it for a little bit because I certainly wanted desperately to get to take this to New York. But even once I was there, you know, I did it for almost 2 years and then accepted an offer to go start it again in Europe and do the first European company in Germany, which is not normally the advice you get from your agents and people. Like when you've just arrived back in New York and been, you know, the title character in a hugely celebrated Broadway musical, most people don't say, you know what you should do next? You should go to Offenbach, Germany for a year and a half and like hang out. But for me, I was paid well to do a show that I really loved doing and live in Europe. And I took every opportunity to like go to France for lunch and come back and do the show because you can do that in Europe. And, you know, every weekend off, I would explore different parts of Europe and ended up getting to know Germany really well, which came quite in handy when I later was asked by John Cameron Mitchell to take over Hedwig. So you never know what choices you're going to make are going to take you to some place that's really where you want to be, but you never would have guessed in the first place. And I've been curious and flexible enough to, you know, to benefit from that kind of life. And I've said before, when I look in the rearview mirror, the whole path makes perfect sense. But from the other end, there's no way I could have imagined or plotted out this, you know, this trip.
We're so glad that that was a success because the people who are going to get to experience you hosting this show coming up, Selected Shorts, is part of the NPR's wonderful radio podcast. It's a special performance of Selected Shorts that's taking place on the Kane stage at Kane University at Enloe Recital Hall. And you are hosting actors Richard Masser and Dana Ivey on November 16th at 7:30. I have to tell you that my daughter and I are huge Broadway fans. It's kind of like our bond. And when I told her that I was coming to see you today, I said, if I don't come back, maybe it's all good. She says, if you're going to go, Dad, you got to go under Sweeney's knife. Because for years, we listened to the Broadway revival of Sweeney Todd. You are absolutely incredible. You are part of my connection with my daughter. So thanks for that, first of all.
Sure.
All right. You, sir, how about a shave? Come and visit your good friend, Sweeney. You, sir, too, sir, welcome to the grave. I will have vengeance. I will have salvation. Who, sir? You, sir? No one in the chat.
People still have to talk to you about that performance.
Oh, yeah, and that's another one of those experiences that that I cherish so much, because Sweeney Todd was the first Broadway show I ever saw, the original production with Len Carreyrou and Angela Lansbury. My dad had taken us all to New York for our first trip to New York from West Virginia. I grew up in Huntington, West Virginia. And so we sat, he was a huge Sondheim fan. He had sat me down in the living room years before and put on the vinyl LP of A Little Night Music when it first came out to, you know, talk me through what was happening in the music and how these were all, you know, waltzes. And so it was very exciting that we were going to be there when a new Sondheim musical was in previews, in fact. So I remember going to the then Eurus Theater, now the Gershwin, which is another thing that was so wonderful about Fun Home, was in Circle and Square, which is underneath what was the Eurus. So really bringing my Broadway life full circle. But we sat in the next to the last row of that theater, which anyone who's seen Wicked knows is a big old theater. And I remember when that whistle blew to start the show, and I had grown up around musicals, but really mostly just Sondheim. You know, that was most of what I listened to. And I did community theater stuff in West Virginia and summer stock in Eastern Kentucky. But I didn't really see a career for myself in musicals. I thought I was a straight dramatic actor. I liked to sing. I loved singing in choirs. I had rock bands and stuff. But I just didn't think musicals were really for me or I for them. And then as I sat watching Len Carew give this Shakespearean performance in a musical, in a really dark musical, I suddenly thought, oh, maybe there is a place in musicals for me. And I came back and saw it 7 times over the next few years. I saw it with George Hearn also, and just couldn't get enough of it. My family, you know, that became the cassette tape on family trips, and, you know, the whole family could sing every note. I think my brother probably still can. And so then when the opportunity to actually get to be in it came up, it was almost too good to be true. And I was a little worried because the original was so indelibly etched in my mind. I was a little concerned that I wasn't going to be able to do anything but try and fail to live up to, you know, Len Carew and George Hearn. And fortunately, John Doyle had an enormous amount of respect and reverence for that production, but no intention of trying to recreate it. So we went back to the nuts and bolts and, you know, and as we were talking about earlier, to the story, to what is actually the story and what do we need to tell that story? So much less than we thought, even down to, I remember the day we started to stage A Little Priest. And so Patty had, you know, a little counter table thing, and we're like, okay, well, we'll need some flour, and we'll need a sifting thing, and she'll need a, you know, a rolling pin, and we'll need a cup. And as we started working, John was like, well, wait, why do we need the flour? Because she doesn't actually say she's baking. She's just telling him about these pies. But we don't necessarily, we assume because Angela Lansbury did that bravura performance with all this stuff that you have to have that. But we realized, no, actually, she's not talking about making the pies. She's talking about having made pies and how bad they are. And do we need her to hold a rolling pin to know that she is baking these things? Well, no, not really.
Here we are, hot from the oven.
What is that?
It's priest. Have a little priest.
Is it really good?
Sir, it's too good, at least. Then again, they don't commit sins of the flesh, so it's pretty fresh.
Awful lot of fat.
Only where it's at.
Haven't you got poet or something like that?
No, you see, the trouble with poet is how do you know it's deceased? Try the priest.
Heavenly.
So it all got reduced to its fundamental archetypal elements, and that allowed all of us to kind of find our own Sweeney, our own Mrs. Lovett, our own Toby. And I think it also, in performing it that way, engaged the audience's imagination in such a vivid, visceral way. I mean, people got nauseous and had to be taken out of the theater and, you know, fainted when we poured red water from one white bucket to another because they saw blood and they saw horrific things happening, but it was because they were doing so much of the work in their imagination because we weren't doing it all for them. It was, John Doyle has an enormous respect for his audience and our audience and the, you know, everybody's ability to have an imagination. That's something that you don't see so much in commercial theater and theater in general. So, you know, that was such a thrill of being a part of something that was a part of my history and being, when I sometimes allow myself to think, oh, you know, I was somebody else's Len Carew. You know, that's that's kind of like you don't get a bigger honor than that.
And you talked about before, you and Patti LuPone, you're storytellers in that. You mentioned you break it all down. So really, it was selected shorts of Sweeney.
It was selected shorts with a tune. Yeah. It really was, and it would have. And in fact, the cast recording, Tommy Krasker, who produced it, really worked with John and Steve to make the album essentially a radio play, you know, listening thing. We retained enough of the dialogues that you could listen to it and get the whole story even today without seeing a bit of it. And I, you know, I love that about it, and I'm really proud of it for that reason. And even the instruments, because we were playing them and we're not, you know, the most highly trained, skilled musicians in the world, but the arrangements had to be stripped way down also. So they, you also hear, in a way that you don't normally, all of the tones of a single cello or a single violin, and you hear the whole story of that each instrument is telling on that recording, as well as the actors. So it really is, you know, storytelling. It really is selected shorts-ish kind of version of Sweeney.
But you are an accomplished musician. As you mentioned, your band Loose Cattle right now, but you've been in other bands. Mm-hmm. So performing guitar, when did you pick that up? When did you first play your guitar?
Well, my father, being a classical musician and music professor, felt an obligation for all of his children to at least spend a year learning an instrument, and we could pick the instrument, and if after a year we didn't want to continue, you know, we didn't have to. But so I think we all started on piano, but it's hard to learn piano from your dad at home. There was a little music program in my grade school, so I in fourth grade started playing violin, and I enjoyed it, but something about the way I played violin made them tell me I should switch to cello. I've never known what exactly that was. I wish I had stuck with either violin or cello, because I love both of those instruments. And I've actually, in recent years, sort of tried to pick up the fiddle again and found that I could play better than I did in fourth grade, but still got some work to do. Spending a lot of time in New Orleans and Louisiana, as I do now, there's a lot of great Cajun fiddle playing, and I've been really inspired by some of my friends who are Cajun fiddle players. But, you know, it was fourth grade, and it wasn't the cool instrument to play, either violin or cello. So I switched to guitar and finished out the 6 months of my year's tutelage learning, you know, just classical guitar, rudimentary classical guitar. I mean, what you would be able to do in fourth grade, and a little bit of jazz. And that was it. And when the year was up, I kind of was done, and I put it away and was involved in whatever other things I was involved in as a kid, probably Little League and Midget Basketball League. And at some point when I was 11 then, I still had the guitar that my dad had bought me, and it had been sitting on the bed, and I just kind of like pulled it out at some point. I probably had like seen somebody playing guitar, and thought maybe I'll pick it out again. And I did, and I sort of retaught myself with some of the books and things that I'd remembered from the beginning, but really kind of self-teaching myself, and got much more into it and really developed my ear a lot, and never really learned to read music properly, which is, you know, a continuing source of frustration, I think, to my dad. And I read relatively for singing and things, but I can read guitar charts, but I really am sort of largely self-taught as a musician. Consequently, I can very easily feel very intimidated by really well-trained musicians. And it took me, because I have such a respect for my father's knowledge and devotion to his craft and his art, I still struggle calling myself a musician, because I still sort of feel like, no, to call yourself a musician, you need to know theory, you need to, you know, have dedicated your whole life to it. But I have dedicated a lot of my life to it, and I have, you know, worked very hard, and I have developed my ear so that I, in junior high, my first bands, like, I would listen to the radio with my ears crammed in the stereo speaker, and I would figure out the bass part and the guitar parts and everything, and then I would come into rehearsal and I would show the parts to the rest of the band and really develop my ability to take apart music in that way. Then over years of just playing, I'd sort of taught myself to play as well. And at a certain point, I finally, and this was like when I was living in Los Angeles, so like in my late 20s, before I actually thought, well, I was meeting all these guys who play guitar and had bands, and I wasn't any great shakes as a guitar player, but I could play as well as these guys. And they were getting like five record deals. And I thought, well, maybe I should stop telling myself I can't be a musician and finish writing some songs and like play stuff. And so I did, but still, like when I remember when we were doing Passion at the Kennedy Center, Judy Kuhn and Rebecca Luker and I were learning that score, and that's a fiendishly difficult score, and your ear can only get you so far. And you know, I was really, really working hard, and just being amazed and intimidated constantly by Rebecca Luker, who's like, is that C sharp? And then is this going to this? And I'm like, yeah, I guess it is. I don't know. Just sing it for me, and I'll like five times, and then I'll know it. So, you know, I've had to accept my limitations but I've also had to accept that I, along the way, develop skills that, you know, that are actually useful and valid also. And somehow I've managed to, you know, fake my way along through to a musical theater career. But I think honestly, most actors and probably most people in general all feel like they're faking life most of the time, and everybody kind of feels like they're going to get caught out at some moment, and someone's going to realize that they don't really have the credentials to do whatever it is they're doing, and everybody feels like other people are better at something than they are. And when I finally stopped letting that stop me from doing things, I'm just like, well, okay, maybe I don't know everything, but I know this. And if I practice, then I can do that, and I'll just do that. So
with that being said, being you're writing songs, we talked about storytelling at the beginning of this interview. What is the story that Michael Servais would like to tell? Either maybe you've already done it through song, or maybe Michael Servais, the playwright.
I have been asked to and thought sometimes about writing, you know, trying to write a theater piece or a book, or you know, I find I often get stumped at what I'm sure most writers feel, that first step of, you know, well, what am I going to write about? And as soon as I start thinking that, then I think, well, I don't know. I don't have anything to write about. And then I sit with it a little longer and I think, oh, well, I have that, but then I have that, and I have this, and I have that, and then there's too many things to write about. And I've worked and been busy trying to fulfill other really brilliant writers' visions that it makes it easy to just go, well, maybe I'll just do that. Because I feel like I am writing and creating as I'm doing that, as I'm serving the writer too. But I have always enjoyed writing, and as you know, any friends who've gotten really long emails from me know, I can go on at length when I have something to say. And I've had a couple of opportunities, like I wrote an article for the New York Times about our experience in Fun Home going to Orlando, and that was really satisfying. And to see that in print in the New York Times was like, and you know, I have a Stringer contract, and that was one of the most exciting things in the world. You know, I guess it's waiting for the combination of a little space, either time-wise or just, you know, mentally to sit with something long enough to start writing. I have a feeling like once I started, it would be easier to continue. I have for a long time had a project that I have been kind of trying to work on with Vic Chestnut, a singer-songwriter from Athens, Georgia, was a friend of mine, passed away some years ago, and I've always, for a while, Les Waters and I were sort of trying to work on a theater piece that would use Vic's songs. So, you know, that's one thing that I've kind of thought I would, you know, like to sit down and try to do sometime. But also just writing something myself. I've written a number of songs, a number of albums for solo records and for my band Loose Cattle. And we're in the process now. We have three songs maybe written for a new album. We kind of started as a cover band, but now we're writing more of our own stuff. We wrote two songs for our Christmas record, and that went really well. Kimberly Kay is my co-songwriter and co-band leader. And she and I wrote a couple of songs, one, Shepherds in a Parking Lot.
Yeah, they tell you that it's Christmas. You put away the year. The ones you miss feel distant, and the ones you lost feel near. And there's broken choirs singing, but their harmony is hard to hear. But maybe you can be the wise one, bringing love where there's a need. For shepherds in a parking lot, maybe fallen angels don't have to quite believe. And sometimes we can sing this Christmas song.
A Cajun song that we wrote with our friends, the Lost Bayou Ramblers, who just won the Grammy last year. That was a really great experience. So, you know, now we're trying to write some more stuff. And I know that it's possible, and maybe this conversation will get me to, you know, get my pen out again and try to do it. I don't know what the story is that I would want to tell. I sometimes find it hard to know what my voice is, because I'm so used to finding voices for other people. I think it's easy for me, for reasons I somewhat understand and somewhat don't, to give voice to someone else's writing. Even when I'm singing songs, this is really interesting, but I have no problem, like, really investing myself into somebody else's song that I'm covering. And, you know, whether it's a David Bowie song or a Stephen Sondheim song, I can, you know, give my all to it. When I'm singing my own songs, I feel so shy, and I have almost no performative aspect to it when I'm performing. And the only way I can get myself past that is to try to trick myself into thinking that the songs I've written were actually written by somebody else and I'm covering myself, and then I can kind of sing it the way I would somebody else's song. And it's maybe partly because when I write, it is personal, and it may not be about a specific person or a specific incident, but there are parts of me that are, you know, being expressed in it. And maybe I'm, you know, shy and used to being able to hide behind a character. I don't know what it is, but I find it pretty consistently. And even now that we've been playing a lot in the band, it's gotten easier, but it's still a challenge.
It's fascinating. You know, from season two of Mindhunter, you're just filming Blacklist. You've done a lot of TV work. You've done film work. And you do all this Broadway stuff, and you have Loose Cattle. Do you ever get a chance to just relax? And if so, what do you do when you have a day to yourself?
I take my dog, Evangeline, out to the dog park. She's very good at, you know, kind of reminding me just how simple things can be. When I was working in Pittsburgh, I was living in Sewickley, and that's very close to a lot of farm country. And I got involved in a wonderful place there, Orchard View Stables, that does equine therapy and uses horses to help PTSD veterans and kids with a variety of emotional and physical challenges. The horses are an incredible tool, I have learned, in treating all kinds of challenges. And the people at Orchard View are this wonderful charity organization. So I would go out and just clean stables. I would get up at 7 o'clock in the morning when I didn't have to and go spend a few hours cleaning stables and you know, tending to the horses. And then I was also learning to ride. And that was some of the most wonderful non-theatrical, non-musical time I've spent in the longest time. And it just was so rewarding. And because it was all being put in the service of helping people too, because we also helped with the lessons, just led the horses around for the lessons while the therapists work. So that was really, really satisfying and really fulfilling. And I've been looking for more places like that in New York area, because there are some, and down in Louisiana also, to continue doing that kind of thing. I like to go see, you know, movies and plays and concerts. I like to fill the well and be inspired by other things. But a lot of the things I do, you know, I'm very fortunate in that what I do to earn a living, you know, more so sometimes than others, but is also the thing that I do. Like, being creative also provides me a home. And so many people have to do a job in order to do the things they really care about. And I get to do a job that is often the things I really care about. So I value getting to spend time with friends, just simple, because when you're on a Broadway schedule, it's very hard to find that time. Spending time with friends and family becomes more valuable to me, not surprisingly, the older that I get. So it's, you know, my downtime is pretty unremarkable, but really necessary, because when I do work, I don't really know how to just punch a clock. And because of the roles that I tend to get, they tend to be like, hello, come in, please now disembowel yourself for the audience's entertainment, emotionally or otherwise, or disembowel other people. That happens too. So, you know, it usually is pretty all-consuming when I am working. So when I'm not doing that, I try to just have a normal life as much as possible, to the extent that I can figure out what that is.
I think it's pretty fascinating what you do, especially when you're talking about the horse therapy and everything. I think that's really interesting. So one last question before we wrap it up. You have only one more opportunity to sing a song. For some reason, your voice goes. So you got one more song to sing. Are you singing your own song? Or are you singing a Broadway tune? Are you singing a song that means the most inside? What would that song be?
You're just full of these great questions, aren't you? It is interesting, because I saw this Linda Ronstadt documentary recently, and then I saw Julie Andrews being interviewed recently, and I've been thinking about that. You know, what happens when you don't have that, or don't have it the way you want to have it to share with other people? I kind of feel like, because I've never thought of myself as a singer per se, I've always sort of thought of myself as an actor who sings, a guitar player who sings. So I think, and because some of my favorite singers are like Tom Waits and, you know, people with, you know, not everybody's idea of the perfect voice, I feel like if I can croak anything out, I will. I've actually also... I was going to tell you about this other project that I've been working on. I've been working on a project with a singer who has had throat surgery, and he started this project back in 2000, and is recording all these songs. And his voice now is very fragile and not. He was never like a trained singer kind of singer, but you know, his voice now is very fragile and very delicate, and yet he uses, and he's recording covers of all of these songs over the last 100 years, and they're nobody's idea of the perfect vocal performance, but they're fantastic because in many ways he unlocks stories that are in the songs that you missed with the original singers because they were such great singers. So I kind of feel like if I could make a sound, I probably would continue to sing. I might not get hired to do it. I might not get a lot of people to come hear me, but I think I wouldn't let imperfection stop me from singing. But if it was a thing where, like, you're just going to have your vocal cords removed or something, my guess is it would be somebody else's song. My guess it would be a song that had meant a huge amount to me. What that song would be, I don't know. It might be something as simple as, you know, "You Are My Sunshine," or
I'd like to see Sweeney sing "You Are My Sunshine."
Well, it was written by a governor from Louisiana who, you know, maybe was a little Sweeney-esque. So, yeah. Well, I mean, in a way, there's a part in the trilogy when Sweeney sings "Joanna" that is a little like that. Yeah. I don't know. It would probably be something just simple and true, and probably somebody else's, but I don't know, maybe mine.
What an opportunity you have to see Michael Cerveris on November 16th at Kane Stage as he hosts Richard Masser and Dana Ivey as they do Selected Shorts at Kane University, and it's a performance you won't want to miss. I'm looking around your place here. I want to make sure there's no razors. No. And no barber chair, and I feel pretty safe right now.
No, they've all been put away over the years. Yeah. You know, the other thing about the Selected Shorts event coming up, it is kind of close enough to the holidays that it has a definite holiday theme. The stories all have sometimes somewhat skewed perspective on the holidays, but it'll be a perfect kind of gentle introduction to the, you know, the maelstrom of holiday activities that are really just around the corner, but it's kind of a gentle way and a slightly non-traditional way into the holiday season for everybody.
It's been a huge honor for me and a really highlight to meet Michael Cerveris. Congratulations on a wonderful career. Keep it up. We look forward to more of your music and more of your performances. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Well, they tell you that it's Christmas, it's their favorite time of year. They tell you count your blessings and remember why we're here. You counted all you could, you couldn't fill one